Chapter 1. In the Beginning. I guess it all started in 1924. That year, I'm 15 years old, living with my parents in a tiny town in northern Wisconsin. Tiny town is right. The town consisted of my father's general store and two small houses clustered by the railroad tracks. That was the town of Kimball, Wisconsin. Around were scraggly farms worked by starving farmers. But it's 1924, and I'm terribly excited by a brand new thing that had just burst in on the American public. It's called radio. Now, in the summer of 1924, radio broadcasting was only 4.5 years old. The first broadcasting our industry has record of is Pittsburgh, November 2, 1920. Election returns. And the radio amateurs around Pittsburgh certainly must have been startled by hearing the human voice mixed in with the dots and dashes they were accustomed to hearing. By now, I'm groping around for information on this new phenomenon. It's hard to come by. There were no books, as none had been written. I had no neighbors to talk to in that very isolated community. I did get a couple pamphlets and a small book from the government printing office in Washington, D.C., but they described commercial wireless stations and were of no use to me. Actually, I got my information from monthly magazines, Popular Mechanics, Science and Invention, and a brand new magazine, Radio News. I could not afford to subscribe to these magazines, but happily I found them in the public library in a nearby town, Hurley, Wisconsin. Hurley was a frontier sort of town with lumbering and mining around. The public library was located upstairs, over the town police station and city jail. The main street in Hurley was lined with saloons, and I do remember the bellows of drunks that had been thrown in the jail below. And I was attending high school in Hurley. I took the train to Hurley in the morning and home again in the afternoon. Happily, the train schedule jived with my school hours. This was years before school buses. And I built a receiver. In 1924, if you wanted a receiver, you had to build it. There were no factories building receivers, although I think there was a new factory building some receivers and selling them in New York. It was called RCA. And I think there were a few entrepreneurs in Minneapolis building receivers in their basements or garages and selling them to wealthy Twin City people. My home-built receiver used a small vacuum tube given to me by my father as a birthday present. It got its power from batteries, as did all radio receivers then and years into the future. Alternating current vacuum tubes were yet to come. I erected a mast in the backyard using slender tree trunks of trees cut down in the nearby woods. Nearby is right. The woods came up to our back door, and I strung out an antenna to my new tower. In those days, and for many years thereafter, if you had a radio receiver in your home, you also had an antenna out back. And I'm sure you remember your folks having a radio receiver in the house and an antenna out there. Of course, some people took them down in the summer, fearing lightning might strike them. And I sat in a little room, about twice the size of a closet. The family called it the radio room. Tuning my little receiver headphones clamped to my ears, I would hear only one station, WEBC in Duluth, 50 miles away. Interestingly, WEBC was a brand new radio station having just come on the air. And it was the only radio station in the entire state of Minnesota, except for two or three stations in the Twin Cities. In Wisconsin, there were no radio stations anywhere except Milwaukee. But my little receiver could not reach out as far as Milwaukee or as far as the Twin Cities. I could only hear WEBC in Duluth. I haunted that receiver, listening hour after hour. The station was only on the air from time to time, an hour now and an hour then. I decided then that when I graduated from high school, I was going to go there and work. That became my dream, and I thought about it constantly. And I did graduate 2 years later, at the age of 17, 1 year ahead of my classmates, because I was one of those bright young fellows who had skipped over the seventh grade. But, alas, now down through the years, all that brilliance has ebbed away, leaving me with only good looks, and I'm now having to make do with that. I wrote the final high school exam that June afternoon in 1926, 70 years ago. But I did not stay for graduation exercises. I was in too much of a hurry to get on with my career. I got on that train the next morning and went to Duluth and immediately started working at WEBC. And I stayed there 28 years. In those years, WEBC expanded into a network called the Arrowhead Network of radio and TV stations in Minnesota and Wisconsin, and it was my job to build those stations and to supervise the engineering. My job was titled Vice President in Charge of Engineering for the Arrowhead Network. But let's go back to that June noon in 1926. The train pulled into the Union Railway Station in Duluth, which is now a railroad museum. I got off the train and walked up those steps to the concourse floor above. I suppose I did present a rather forlorn sight. I did not have a suitcase. Instead, the few clothes I brought with me were rolled up in a newspaper. The traveler's aid lady on duty that noon stopped me and asked if I had a place to go, if I had money, if I was all right. I said yes, yes to every question, although none was true. There was always a traveler's aid lady at every railroad station. A lady, as men had jobs and only women had time to devote to this volunteer work. I walked out of the railroad station and across Michigan Street to the Spalding Hotel and up to the second floor and around to the back, where I found the WEBC studio where I knew I would find it, having heard them talk about it so many times in the past 2 years. The studio was a hotel bedroom made into a radio studio by hanging heavy black drapes along the walls and across the ceiling. The light was dim in there, and the sound very dead. Across the hall, I found another hotel bedroom, a combination storeroom and office. There I found Leslie Ross, the owner of WEBC. His principal occupation was his Ross Electric Shop in Superior. Actually, he was running WEBC as a hobby, which had no income and supported entirely by proceeds from his electric shop. And here is one of the early great pioneers in broadcasting. I have never seen his name or heard mention of him since, and I suppose I'm the only one who knows there was ever a Leslie Ross. I can still see him sitting there, gray suit, sandy hair, and crinkles around his eyes, and he was grinning. I suppose he was amused by this young man who stood there saying, "I am going to work here." He asked me some questions about WEBC, and of course I could answer him, having listened to the station so much in the past 2 years. Finally, he said, "Well, if you're going to work here, you might as well get started." And I got started, and I kept on getting started for 28 years. Of course, there was no money for salary, as Leslie was having a very tough time paying bills for power and rents with money coming only from his electric shop. So I had to get a job to support myself, and I found myself as a busboy in the restaurants of a brand new downtown hotel. Now, I had two jobs, and I was always tired and hungry, but I was very happy. I was now a broadcaster. I was not just a listener like everyone else. I was now producing radio. I was in the middle of the action. That first summer was a little bit rugged, but I was young and excited. My idea of sheer heaven was to go into a cafe there on Superior Street and have a 5-cent bottle of ice-cold milk and sit there and slowly sip it. And somewhere along that summer, my father sent me a letter enclosing a $10 bill, equivalent to $40 or $50 today, I suppose. He said he knew I was having a tough time and maybe this would help. What did I do? I returned it to him, saying I did not need it. Oh, boy, I did, though, but I was a proud young man. I was now a man in a man's world. I was not a boy any longer. I could take care of myself. I didn't need help from anybody. But I was no different than all the other young fellows of that day. We all had the same idea. I was just one of the crowd. Today, there are many young men and women out there with the same philosophy. Once they leave home, they make it on their own. They don't need help from anybody. I know as wife June and I raised 4 sons, all of whom went out on their own, and all have been very successful. They drive Mercedes and Lincoln Continentals, while I drive a little old tired Mazda. None of them, however, would come in the broadcasting station business. They've been too successful in their own kind of business to leave it for broadcasting. Along about Christmas time, Leslie started selling advertising. Here again, he was a pioneer. I do not recall how much he collected for each ad. It was likely 25 cents, but I do recall I scrawled out those ads on tablet paper, and I read them on the air. The result must have been unbelievable, but the listener did not mind. Radio was so new and exciting you could do anything, and the listener would think it was wonderful. And those ads must have had real impact. We had a real captive audience of avid listeners. But now, there was some money around, and one day, after Leslie had paid some bills, he looked down at his hands and he saw he had $12.50 left, and he handed it to me, saying, "Here's your salary, Charlie." And bless his heart, he kept on giving that to me every week, although he later raised it to $15, which remained at that figure for quite some time to come. Now, I could quit that part-time job at the hotel and devote all my time to broadcasting. My dream had really come true. How lucky could a guy get? There were two others at the studio when I came, Norman Conrad and Florence Scovold. They lived at home in town, so did not need a job to live, and they faded away shortly after I came, and I have no idea what became of them, although I do recall hearing Florence, a stunning blonde, had joined a vaudeville team and went touring the country with them. But you notice there were women in broadcasting even way back then. And it has always been that way in broadcasting, men and women working together, side by side. Never any discrimination. Yet today, the FCC in Washington insists that when broadcasters list employees in annual reports that women be classified as members of the minority race. What minority? Over in Superior was Walter Bridges, who attended the transmitter, which was housed in a small penthouse room on the roof of the Evening Telegram newspaper building. On the same roof was two towers, one on each end of the building, with the transmitting antenna hung in between in the manner of broadcast stations of that day. This building was three stories high. You always located your transmitter and antenna on top of the tallest building in the town. The waves went out further that way. If you were in a town with a 45-story building, you had it made, believe me. And this is the way we broadcast. I played very few phonograph records. To do so, I had to place the microphone on the floor in front of an acoustic phonograph and then wind up the phonograph motor. Then I could not talk because my talking would go out on the air along with the music, although I don't suppose it would have mattered much. This was before phonograph pickups, before phonograph amplifiers, before loudspeakers, and the music coming out of that acoustic phonograph was incredibly shrill, and after it went through our transmitting equipment, it became even more shrill. But who cared? All the listeners wanted was a sound, any kind of sound. Hi-fi was many years in the future. At 7:30 a.m., I would sit down at a table in the studio, open the morning paper, the Duluth News Tribune, and read the news. This was the only news period of the day, and radio stations all across the country were doing the same. At first, the newspapers were very happy about this, as we were publicizing their papers. They used to print columns suggesting listeners try this circuit, this kind of antenna, these headphones, encouraging their readers to listen to the radio. Then one day, the newspapers discovered radio stations were selling advertising in competition, and that's when all the fun went out of it for them, and they told us to stop. All across the country, they told us to stop, and we didn't stop. It got into the courts, and now the court had to decide. Who owned the news after the newspaper hit the street? Did the news still belong to the newspaper, or did it belong to the public domain? In the end, the court decided the news belonged to the newspaper, and then we did have to stop, unless we paid the newspaper a fee for the use of their news. Of course, we never did. We had no money for fees, and news wasn't that important in radio anyway. At noon, I would walk down Superior Street three blocks to 2nd Avenue and the Glass Block Store and up to the 5th floor and the Grailson Dining Room, where through the noon hour, the Grailson String Ensemble would provide music for the noon diners, likely paying 50 cents or 75 cents for their lunch. Victor Herbert and Romberg, wonderful tunes, while I struggled with the names of the musical selections and composers. Announcers, we didn't have any of those. They were a luxury that crept in later. If you worked for a radio station those days, your principal job was designing and building and maintaining the broadcast equipment. There were no factories building broadcast equipment. Every station across the country was homemade. We used to visit each other's stations to see how they built theirs. As for announcing at WEBC, it seemed that whoever happened to be standing around was the announcer, and most of the time it was me that was standing around. Sometimes in the late afternoon, I would walk up 2nd Avenue, a half block, to the Garrick Theater, where I would broadcast the music of Leland McQueen at the mighty Wurlitzer pipe organ as he played for the silent pictures. This was before the talkies. Today, the Garrick Theater's gone. A parking ramp is there. The glass block store is gone. A bank building is there. The Spalding Hotel is gone. An office building is there. All is gone. Except me. I am all that's left of those long ago days, and people tell me I will be gone someday too, but you notice how cleverly I've been putting off that day up to now. At 6 p.m., I would be in the dining room on the main floor of the Spalding Hotel. Remember, our studio was on the second floor, broadcasting the music of another string ensemble for the diners who were perhaps paying $1.25 or $1.50 for their evening meal. Some more beautiful music. Oh, how gracefully we lived in those days. We heard very little music as we had to be near a real live orchestra to do so, and we cherished it. Today, there's music everywhere. In the ceilings of stores we shop in our cars, in boomboxes, and music today is just one of the less objectionable sounds in our noisy environment. Of course, there are still a few people who still attend symphony concerts and have hi-fi sets in their homes. God bless them all. At 7 p.m., I would run upstairs to the studio on the second floor, and broadcasting from the studio would begin. Nothing was planned. If you could play an instrument, could sing any kind of song, could recite poetry, or tell stories, you came unannounced and uninvited. And you stood along the wall in the studio or along the wall in the hall and waited your turn. And when your turn came, you stepped up to the microphone and did your bit. At home, your family and your neighbors would be crouched over their crystal receiving sets, and you would be famous around your neighborhood for a few days because you had been on the radio. And I do remember one lovely dark-haired girl who always came alone, never spoke to anyone, and always left alone. And when her turn came, she would step up to the microphone and in a deep, throaty voice would sing sad songs like In the Glooming or Just a Wearying for You, obviously a message to some young man out there in radio land. She came a few times and then didn't come anymore, and I have no idea what happened to her. If she's still around, she now is a white-haired grandmother remembering those days so long ago. Then there were the regulars, John Willett, the old-time fiddler, and George Babb from Lake Nebogadon, who told droll stories. One time in the middle of a story, in the middle of a sentence, his voice became muffled. Then there was silence, and the next thing we heard was, "Damn that upper set!" And so went the evening. 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, maybe 11 o'clock, and there was no one left standing in the studio, and I would look out in the hall, and there was no one there. I was all alone. Then, over in Superior, Walter Bridges would pull the big switch, and the whining generators would descend to silence. All broadcast transmitters those days were powered by DC generators. WEBC was a 500-watt station operating on 242 meters. I never bothered to figure out what that was in kilocycles. It did not seem important. We are right there in the middle of the dial. You can't miss us, and there's no one else. Sunday morning, I would take the streetcar over to Superior and to the Hammond Avenue Presbyterian Church, where I would broadcast the morning church service. Reverend Senti, the pastor, was a sentimental man who would sometimes break down and cry in the pulpit. I was to teach a Sunday school class there later. Sunday evening, I would trudge up the hill in downtown Duluth to broadcast the evening services from the Methodist Church. Reverend Pace was the pastor. I set the broadcasting equipment up in a small room behind the pulpit, out of sight of the congregation. One time, because I was always tired, I laid down on folding wooden chairs, headphones on, listening, and once the good pastor let out a yell as part of his sermon, and it so startled me I fell off the chairs with a loud crash. Reverend Pace stopped his sermon and came back to see what was going on. Sometimes I would take the streetcar to Superior and out to the fairgrounds to broadcast a description of the greyhound dog races with those sleek greyhounds chasing an artificial rabbit around the track. Then came the World Series, and I broadcast the description of the games by going downstairs to the newsroom in the newspaper in Superior, where our transmitter was located. Microphone in hand, I stood behind the telegraph operator, reading over his shoulder, as he typed out a running account of the game, play by play and inning by inning. In those days, all news from outside town came to that town and to that newspaper through that one telegraph operator. Newspapers in small towns were actually local newspapers with very little news from across the state, across the country, and across the globe. We actually knew very little of what was going on around the world. Today, if two tribes in the middle of Africa get to shooting at each other, we now know about it instantly in our living rooms and in color yet. Are we happier? Are we better off? I will argue with you about that someday when we meet on the street. Then there was a big prize fight one evening, and once again I was in the newsroom, mic in hand, reading over the shoulder of the telegraph operator. Somewhere out there, ringside, was a reporter with a telegraph key in hand, clicking off the fight, blow by blow, round by round. Then something big happened. The President of the United States, Calvin Coolidge, and his wife came to the head of the lakes for his summer vacation 3 months long. Only, he didn't come to the head of the lakes. He came to fish in the Brule River in northern Wisconsin, 30 miles east of Duluth Superior. The day his private train came in, I was at the depot, on a baggage cart, microphone in hand, describing this momentous event. It was about 8 in the morning, and 20 or 30 people stood around. The President's train came to the Superior Depot, not the Duluth Depot, as Superior was closer to the Brule River. There were a couple baggage cars, some Pullman cars, and the last car was the President's private car. He and Mrs. Coolidge got off and into a touring car and were whisked off to the lodge on the Brule. I saw them again during the summer. I just happened to be standing alone on the corner of Belknap and Hammond Avenue streets in residential Superior, and they came by. They were on their way to make a tour of Duluth. The Duluth voters, good Republicans, had voted for him, and now he was in nearby Wisconsin, ignoring them. So now a tour of the city to remind them he really did love them. He and Mrs. Coolidge sat in the back of a touring car with the top down. Had it been raining, the top would have been pulled up. In front was a chauffeur in uniform, and in the back sat the President and his wife. As they went by, I waved to them, and Mrs. Coolidge, a very gracious lady, waved back to me. Cal sat there staring straight ahead, a sour look on his face, mad because this damn fool tour had interrupted his morning fishing. Then, of course, I saw them again when they left. It was about 8 in the evening, and I was again, microphone in hand, standing on a baggage cart, describing this important event. About 8 or 10 people stood around. No big deal. His private train would wend its way through Wisconsin all night to Chicago. There he would give a speech, and the next night he would travel on to Washington. Trips to the East Coast were always a two-night affair, and I did this often in the years that followed. I had to make business trips to Washington or to New York, and sometimes I just made up trips. They were the only vacation I took those years, and they were a vacation. I would get on the train in Duluth at 8 p.m., go to my room, take off my shoes and necktie, and relax. The rooms were complete with bathroom and bed, and so comfortable. At breakfast time, I would wander over to the dining car and enjoy ham and eggs. The train would arrive in Chicago at 8 a.m. I would wander around downtown Chicago till 1 p.m., when I always went to the Chicago Theater for their 1 p.m. matinee, where all the vaudeville greats appeared. Pearl Bailey, Eddie Dutchin, and all the rest. At 3 p.m., I would be at the train leaving for either New York or Washington. The Penzi train if it were to Washington, or the New York Central if I were going to New York. Each train was a sort of palace on wheels. A secretary if you had business to transact, a barber if you needed a haircut, a plush cocktail lounge and comfortable rooms for you to relax in. At dinner time, a gourmet meal as all trains competed with each other for excellence in food. We talked about the food in the Penzi trains and the New York Central trains. How luxuriously we traveled those days. Today, travelers are stuffed like sardines in an aluminum tube they call an airplane, which blasts off to your destination with you arriving almost right away. And if food is served, it's almost inedible. This is progress? Are we living better today? I will argue with you about this should I meet you on the street. While the president was vacationing on the Brule, I visited his summer White House office located in the Central High School in downtown Superior a couple times. No passes needed, no guards. You just walked in, and inside you likely would find a staff member, feet on a desk reading a newspaper. In another corner, a staff member eating his lunch out of a brown bag, and somewhere in the room, three or four staff members playing poker. And if you stood there long enough, a phone might ring. A staff member would lay down his cards and pick up the phone while the game paused. Being a president in those days was hardly more than a part-time job, although he received full-time pay. It seemed that his principal job was that as official greeter to important kings and presidents from other countries. Well, somebody had to do it. And once a year, he would issue a proclamation naming May 8th as Mother's Day. And I guess he did other important things, too. Governing in those days was done by the states. Every 2 years, the state-elected officials would gather in their respective state capitals and pass two or three laws, and not 200 or 300 laws like today. Then they would go back to the farm. And in Washington, the duly elected officials would gather every couple of years or so, and between cocktail parties, which took up most of the time, they would gather in their respective chambers and debate great issues like immigration quotas, tariffs, and whether or not the nation should go on the gold standard. I never figured out what that was. Maybe we were on it all the time and nobody told me. The only time the national government was important was in time of war. At that time, the president would stand up and say, "Come on now, you fellows. We have a war going on. Let's all get together and fight this here war." Study your history and you'll find that American history is a history of wars. There's not much history in between. So went the first 2 years I was in broadcasting. And in the 68 years that have followed, much has happened to me, some of which is chronicled in the pages to come. In those days, the son always followed in the footsteps of his father. If the father were a farmer, so was the son. If the father were a miner, so was the son. It was all pretty predictable. But in every generation, there are the rebellious ones, those who do not fit into the society they find themselves in. The poet Thoreau has written about those. The poet wrote, saying, "If a man does not keep pace with his companions, perhaps it is because he hears a different drummer. Let him step to the music he hears, however measured or far away." My father was a storekeeper. I should have been a storekeeper, but I was listening to a different drummer. A generation later, young men flew airplanes, and they starved too, but they built up the airlines. Everything is different, but the pattern is the same.